It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Joff Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Well, as usual, another week with
busy week. Yeah.
What's going on with that? Well, let's get started then. Let's dive right in. There's and plenty of local stuff too this week, which isn't always the case, but in this week, yeah,
there was a lot this week, no question.
So it looks like the city council has finally figured out a replacement for Jim Compton.
Yeah, there was good news and bad news on the city council this week. The bad news, or at least indifferent news, was the appointment of Sally Clark as the one of the six finalists who made it. Six finalists were appointed on Monday. All of them women, five of them women of color. Unfortunately, the person who was appointed was the sixth, Sally Clark. We had thought in the beginning of the week, Sharon Maeda, who was the most progressive of the lot and the one who had the best activist record, she had gotten votes from all eight of the city council members, so she looked like the odds-on favorite. But it turned out to be Sally Clark, who is exactly the sort of civic do-gooder, liberal Democrat, won't-rock-a-boat type that we've been predicting all along would be the council's preference. In fact, when there was the original list of 99, I kind of had my money on Clark, and then I got my hopes up for Maeda. You know, Clark has a history with the Lifelong AIDS Alliance. She's gay. She's obviously a liberal Democrat. Time will tell how she does. The problem, of course, is that she's immediately got to turn around and run for re-election twice, and she has said she will run for the seat permanently. There will be a special election in November to fill out the term, but the term will only be filled out for a year. She has to run for it again in 2007. So it means that almost immediately she, and for that matter anybody who'd been appointed to the seat who wanted to hang on to it permanently, will have to spend a big chunk of their time raising money, and will be pretty beholden in what they do in the council to their donors, particularly their larger donors. So we'll see what Sally Clark does when it's on the council. But if nothing else for that structural reason, let alone for her political history, I'm not very hopeful. The good news this week was that as a compromise candidate, Nick Licata emerged as the president of the council for the next 2 years. It had originally been deadlocked 4-4 between Gene Godden and Richard Conlon. The council didn't want it to be dependent on a ninth vote from a new council member. Conlon unexpectedly stepped aside Monday morning, and Licata emerged very quickly as the compromise candidate. That's very good news because Licata, along with Richard Conlon, have been the council members who have most consistently challenged the pro-developer, pro-Vulcan, pro-big money agenda of Greg Nichols. Very few other people on the council have, with Licata at the helm, setting the agenda and issuing the committee assignments for the council. There's much more of a chance that the city council will be something other than a rubber stamp for Greg Nichols' plans, and that's something we haven't seen in the first four years of Nichols' rule.
Well, I didn't have as strong a reaction as several emails I had seen about Sally Clark getting, you know, the council position. I mean, yeah, mm-hmm. I would have voted for other people than her, but for sure she's going to be an improvement over Compton. I mean, there's no question there. And
I wouldn't necessarily say that. I think the jury is out. I think left to her own devices, that would probably be true. But the imperative to raise campaign cash is going to influence things, I think.
Well, and if you read her comment, I mean, she didn't actually even show up for the actual when they were choosing the winner there, because which I was jazzed by this, where said she stayed and worked because she had too much work to do back at her other job. So I mean, I saw that as a good indicator, but who knows, that could just be, you know, playing the press for what they are. But as you had said, the jury's still out. So
yeah, It is.
And time will tell.
And I think hearing from constituents who want her to do the right thing on upcoming issues like, you know, we'll talk about this a little bit later, but at some point the city is going to have to sign off on the Sonics plans. You know, issues like that are going to tell us a lot about her in the coming few months.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, moving over to the state level of things, civil rights, gay civil rights passed.
Yeah, after 20, actually closer to 30 years, the gay civil rights legislation finally passed this year. You can probably thank Reverend Ken Hutcherson and the blowback from his blowhardiness last year and this year, for that matter, for getting Bill Finkbeamer to change his vote. The final vote in the Senate was 25-23 yesterday. The House then turned around and passed the amended Senate version 61-38, and Gregoire has said she will sign it on Tuesday. All very, very good news. The dark lining on this, actually, there's two of them. The first is that opponents of the gay civil rights bill are talking about mounting a referendum this fall on the ballot to try and repeal the gay civil rights bill. The second piece of that, which could be even more ominous or not, is that the Washington State Supreme Court is expected at any time now to issue a ruling on the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act, and which bans gay marriage. And if the Washington State Supreme Court strikes that down, that will almost certainly mean there will be a lot of pressure on the legislature to act one way or the other. And at that point, you are almost certainly going to see probably something anti-gay on the fall ballot, which could take out the civil rights bill along with it. So there's still some perilous times ahead for all the people who worked very hard, gay and straight, to get this legislation passed. They definitely deserve to celebrate right now. They've done a marvelous job, but don't pack up and go home just yet, because there'll be a lot still to happen this year, one way or the other on that.
All right, and if people were to get something on that ballot, wouldn't that come from an initiative?
It would come from an initiative, or in the case of legislation being passed by the legislature that that is desired to be repealed, that would be a referendum. Okay. But it's the same effect.
All right.
It would still go on the statewide ballot.
Well,
and it would still require signatures in order to do it.
Well, and I bring up the initiative because you were commenting on the blog this week that there's a particular elected representative that seems to be against initiatives.
Yeah, there were several bills that held a hearing on on Thursday in front of the Government and Elections Committee that would curtail the ability of initiative backers to put initiatives on ballots, things like banning the practice of paid initiative gathers and things like that. But the most far-reaching of them was sponsored by Senator Ken Jacobson, a guy that I've been taking shots at for a while now for sort of banal legislation like naming the Gary Oak the state's official oak tree, requiring first responders to save pets in the event of a disaster, the sorts of things liberal Senate Democrats and House Democrats from Seattle with safe seats shouldn't be doing. They should be using their safe seats in order to take risks and fight for progressive causes. They don't do that here in Seattle, and they could probably use a wake-up call. Well, Senator Jacobson has put a meaningful piece of legislation on the floor. The piece of meaningful legislation he's put on the floor would ban initiatives entirely, and there's one reason he's doing this. It's to get back at Tim Iman because he's a sore loser. Well, the problem with this is that Tim Iman is the most probably notorious person, who puts out initiatives, but he's hardly the only person. And in fact, a fair number of initiatives are progressive. We had the anti-smoking ban last year. We had Hanford cleanup the year before that, both of which passed with pretty wide majorities. And in general, initiatives are there to allow voters to pass legislation that the legislature won't get around to. And in a corporate controlled legislature, which, you know, like it or not, Olympia by and large is, although it's certainly more accessible than Congress, you know, you need that safety valve of the people being able to get legislation passed. So, you know, legislation that somebody like Jacobson should be supporting, instead he wants to disenfranchise voters from doing the job he's not doing, in order to get a Tim Emmon, rather than, say, convincing voters that Tim Emmon is wrong. So anyway, for people who would like to defend the idea of initiatives being valid, the legislation is Senate Joint Resolution 8201, and it wouldn't ban initiatives outright. It would put it on the ballot in November, but nonetheless, it shouldn't even go that far. The legislature shouldn't be meddling in the people's right to make laws.
Well, at least it's not an initiative to eliminate initiatives.
There you go. Oh, by the way, Jacobson is up for re-election this year, and he had a priceless quote Thursday when he was defending the initiative process, something to the effect of, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but it was something to the effect of, if people don't like the legislation that I put, first of all, that initiatives destroy the Republican form of government, and if people don't like the legislation that I put forward, they can refuse to elect me. I think that's an excellent idea. He's running for re-election this year in the 46th District in North Seattle. Somebody should go after him and at least remind him that he works for the people.
All right. Well, I saw in this week's paper as well, it looks like the Sonics, who weren't getting their way at the city level, are taking it to the state level.
It's not so much that they're not getting their way at the city level. They will still have to get city approval for taxpayer funding for a new stadium. But the city wasn't moving fast enough for them, and they wanted to sort of goose things along by getting approval for a funding package from the state legislature. What they want to do is tear down Key Arena entirely, build an entirely new arena on the site of Key Arena for $271.5 million, and unlike the mayor, and unlike the Seahawks, they want taxpayers to pick up the entire cost of the arena. They're not even going to pick up part of it themselves. They want an extension of the King County Hotel and Restaurant tax, which was used to pay for Safeco Field, in order to pay for the entire building of a new arena. This is something that, speaking of liberal Seattle Democrats who aren't doing their job, we have exactly that type of creature that's sponsoring the bills, Margarita Prentice of Renton, the chair of the Senate Ways and Means Committee, sponsoring Senate Bill 6849. And then we have over in the House, Jim McIntyre, also from Seattle, of the chair, House Finance Committee, sponsoring House Bill 3233. And I was just introduced on Wednesday. And, this comes only 12 years after taxpayers spent something like $73 million to refurbish Key Arena. But what the Sonics are claiming is that after Quest Field and after Safeco opened, they've been losing money because they've been losing skybox revenue to the Seahawks and the Mariners. So what this basically boils down to is they want an entirely new building because there aren't enough amenities for rich people compared to what the Seahawks and Mariners have. And they want us to pick up $270 million so that those rich people can watch basketball games in greater comfort. I'm not impressed. I don't know about you.
Yeah. I found it interesting that, yeah, they're using the excuse of that the Seahawks and the Mariners have this better toy now, and so we deserve it too. And, you know, where does this stop? And then so the Sonics get something new, and then the Seahawks and Mariners will be, well, these stadiums aren't adequate anymore because look what the Sonics got.
Exactly. It's they're playing one off against the other. And at some point, and bear in mind that the Mariners in particular kind of got rammed down our throat when the people voted against it, and then the state legislature turned around and passed it anyway. And a lot of people are still very resentful, even a decade later, about those stadiums. I think this is going to be a real hard sell for the Sonics. They've been making noises about moving to Bellevue or even to Kansas City. I think Kansas City is a fine place to go during the winter. They should enjoy it. The other interesting thing about this is that if you need more ammunition, is that Wally Walker, the president of the Sonics, is a very outspoken and fairly rabid, actually, conservative Republican. To the point where that was the main reason he hired Paul Westfall as coach a few years ago, was that a big reason was that Westfall was buddies with Rush Limbaugh. And it was also a reason he fired George Carl a few years ago, a very successful coach, because Carl was politically liberal. Walker, incidentally, moved the broadcast rights of the station this week from KJR, an all-sports station, to an all-conservative talk station, KTTH, The Truth. So this is a guy who presumably believes in free markets and free enterprise, and yet he wants taxpayers to pick up the his business's capital costs, and just something doesn't add up there.
All right, and briefly, the Queen Anne QFC is looking at people are getting. Coming to meetings, getting pretty upset.
Yeah, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. The big development that Kroger owns, QFC, is trying to put in where the current Metropolitan Market is on Queen Anne Avenue North at the top of the hill. There was another meeting this week. It was the meeting at which people from Kroger were unveiling the new design for the building, a 38,000 square foot grocery store, a big box with underground parking and parking and retail also on the second floor. 250 people showed up at Bethany Presbyterian Church to unanimously object to the design. In fact, everybody on the Queen Anne Community Council Land Use Review Committee, which was the committee looking at this design, also rejected the design, largely because it detracted from the supply of housing and affordable housing on Queen Anne. The plan requires tearing down the Alfreda apartments as well as replacing Metropolitan Market. Turns out there's another, what could almost be a twin of this development, except for the fact that it's tearing down a vacated grocery store rather than an existing one. This is in Wallingford at 40th and Stone Way. People may remember that there was a Safeway there about 5 years ago, and that building's been standing empty for a long time. Well, turns out Kroger wants to put another big box development there. They are very intent on having QFC taking over the grocery business in the Seattle area. Even though they took over the food giant and have a store in Wallingford now, at 45th and Wallingford, they want the Stoneway store. They want it to have residential component as well. They want it to have other retail, parking underground, all the rest of it. It's not a very big lot, so I don't know how they're going to shoehorn it all in, but it's got real problems with things like putting trucks into a residential side street that doesn't really have room for them. And again, there is a neighborhood group that's fighting it in Wallingford.
Well, I think they do need something there, but the size that they keep putting these stores in are just
It's like put another grocery store there, but it, you know,
the same footprint.
It can be a grocery store. It doesn't have to be a big box giant,
right? And more we're seeing across the country where people are successfully resisting these big box stores.
Yeah, 800 people turned out in Spokane last night to object to a Walmart that's being proposed for South Hill.
All right. Well, let's jump along to National. Alito looks like there might be some resistance to that.
Yeah. After 9 o'clock, I know Positive Vibrations is a wonderful show, but take a couple minutes to pick up the phone and call Murray and call Cantwell and urge them to support John Kerry and Edward Kennedy's filibuster against Samuel Alito when Frist moves it to a vote sometime Monday afternoon or Tuesday morning. Both Murray and Cantwell have said they will vote against Alito. Neither one has said whether they will support a filibuster, at least as far as I'm aware. And it's essential. It's probably a futile exercise. There's no question that Alito has the votes, but there has to be a record that Democrats oppose this. And for that matter, there should be a record of Republicans opposing this too, although it's not happening. Alito is just so bad on so many levels that the filibuster and the opposition and the using of every procedural trick in the book, maybe a few that aren't, is necessary just to underline and underscore and double underscore the point that this guy is bad for the country. So I would really urge people to call Cantwell to call Murray as well. Their numbers, I have them right here if I can actually read them. For Murray, it's, and these are the DC numbers. There are also some free congressional switchboards out there that various groups use, where you tell the operator which office you want and she connects you. But the direct lines are 20 for Murray. It's 202-224-2621. And then for Maria Cantwell, 202-224-3441. And if you missed those, or if you want fax numbers or emails, they're on the ETS blog at www.eatthestate.org, and then you click the ETS blog little link on the right-hand side. Please do that. Do that today. Do it again tomorrow. There's nobody in the office over the weekend, of course, but starting 6 a.m. Pacific time on Monday morning, there will be. So flood their offices with phone calls and let them know how you feel, because Alito is bad, bad, bad news. Parenthetically, Harry Reid was quoted, the Senate minority leader, as saying the whole thing was a waste of time, yada, yada, yada. That's exactly the sort of spineless rolling over that Democrats do not need. And for that matter, exactly why a lot of people don't think Democrats stand for anything, because they're so willing to give up and because they're so willing to tell their opponents that their opponents have nothing to fear. So that was extremely disappointing. But please call Murray. Please call Cantwell. Urge them to do the right thing. Even if it won't make a difference to the final tally, it'll let us know where they stand.
Yeah, and just the act of calling regularly and letting the representatives know what you think should be a regular part of all of our day, regardless of your one's viewpoints on particular issues.
Yeah, put them on the speed dial. Absolutely.
All right. Tuesday night, State of the Union?
Yeah, coming up. And the Democrats inexplicably, I had a blog item sometime in December saying I thought Jack Murtha would be a great spokesperson for the Democratic Party. Not necessarily because people agree with his call to withdraw troops from Iraq, although I do, but because he stands for something, because he's not spineless, because he's willing to take political risks for something he believes in. Well, the Democrats have gone in exactly the opposite direction. They've named Tim Kaine to give the a rebuttal to President Bush on Tuesday night.
Who is Tim Kaine?
That's a good question, and one shared by about 280 million Americans. Tim Kaine is the incoming governor of Virginia. He was elected as such in November to replace another moderate Democrat. He is being picked specifically because he is a red state Democratic governor, although Brian Schweitzer in Montana, who actually has a track record, who is actually wildly popular, would have probably been a far better choice if that's what you wanted to do. Absolutely nobody knows who Tim Kaine is. Turns out from people who've seen him on C-SPAN and other places that he's a pretty boring public speaker, so it's not that. It's not that he will oppose President Bush. He supports the war in Iraq pretty much just the way Bush is fighting it. He likes a lot of the things that Bush does. It's not though as though he has red state appeal, because a lot of his appeal actually comes from the very liberal D.C. suburbs of Northern Virginia, which is not exactly a red state yardstick, but he's part of the Democratic Beltway elite. And this is why he's got this plum assignment. It has absolutely nothing to do with what people in the viewing audience are actually going to think of this guy. And what they're going to think of him is, who is the hell is this? And isn't there something better on TV? It's really an extraordinary waste of an opportunity to get the Democrats' message out. Williams River Pitt, invaluable commentator over at Truthout, had a great suggestion last weekend. He wants, and if you're calling Murray and Cantwell, you might suggest this idea to him while you're getting him to try and filibuster Alito. He wants some or all Democratic senators at some predetermined point during Bush's speech to stand up, turn their backs, and walk out. And I think that would be grand political theater, and it would say more eloquently than any catcalling or any speeches afterwards, or certainly Tim Kaine's response, just what the Democrats think of being, you know, lied to and spit on and disrespected the way they routinely are. I mean, you know, why the Democrats are not capable of understanding that the Republicans want to exterminate them is just beyond me. So hopefully at some point they'll get that, but urge him to walk out. Let's see what happens.
All right, and quickly an Abramoff update.
Yeah, very quickly, Bush undercut the Department of Justice Abramoff investigation this week by naming the chief investigator, Noel Hillman, to a federal judgeship, meaning that somebody brand new has to come in and get them be named to head the investigation and get themselves up to speed. Well, the White House says this is all routine business and a coincidence and whatnot, which might even be plausible, except that Bush has done this before. In 2002, when Jack Abramoff was part of a corruption probe in Guam, the acting U.S. attorney who was heading that investigation was called off the case by President Bush, and the investigation died. So the fact that Bush is trying to disrupt this case tells us a lot about just how close Abramoff was to Bush, even though the White House is trying to stonewall that, tells us a lot about how politically and perhaps legally vulnerable Bush is. He's going to try and derail this investigation. He probably won't succeed, but he will try, and this should tell us it's happening.
All right. Big elections in Palestine this week.
Yeah, Hamas, the Islamist group that has been responsible for a lot of suicide bombings in Israel over the years, won 76 out of 132 legislative seats in the Palestinian Authority this week. Not really at all a surprise. This even though the ruling Fatah party had actually delayed the election and jury-rigged the election laws to try and be favorable to them. But Hamas was going to win. They were going to win because Mahmoud Abbas, the existing president from Fatah, was seen as pro-U.S. Because Hamas is youth-oriented and the demographics of Palestine are overwhelmingly under age 25. Because Hamas has a long record of honesty and of public service in a land where most government officials are known for corruption and being indifferent to their constituents. And because Hamas stands for something, you know, their strength is in Gaza, and they were claiming that the reason is Israel withdrew from Gaza is because Hamas was uncompromising, and a lot of Palestinians believe that. It also has not helped that Israel over the past several years has jettisoned the peace process, has built an apartheid wall, has routinely gone into refugee camps like Jenin and caused bloodbaths, has continued to erect highways and checkpoints and carve the Palestinians into ever smaller Bantustans, and it's just you know, Bush and Sharon have done everything possible, it seems like, to make the Palestinians' lives worse, and this is a response to that. And Bush basically elected Hamas, just as he has in Iraq and Egypt and Iran helped trigger gains for Islamist parties. That's happened again in Palestine.
And unfortunately, we only got about a minute for you to cover what's going on in Iraq.
Yeah, let's see, the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction had a secret report leaked this week talking about extreme waste and corruption and fraud within the U.S. reconstruction effort in Iraq. Some very, very good articles in this week, and I think Tuesday and Wednesday in the New York Times. It's in the ETS blog, and some really telling and blood turning excerpts from it are in there and in the original New York Times articles as well. So people should check that out. And then also we learned this week another significant step closer to all-out civil war. The Kurdish foreign minister announced that there would be no Arab League National Accord Conference in Cairo in February, that the various parties will not be trying to negotiate with each other at any time in the foreseeable future. This, again, is another step closer to all-out civil war.
Talking, as we do every week, with Ja Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. It's absolutely free. You get it at places where you get bookstores and cafes and coffee shops and places like that where you get free periodicals. It's also on the web, www.eatthestate.org. Mentioned a couple times the blog that we have there where a lot of these stories appear, too. It's an all-volunteer organization, so we can always use donations as well as tips and volunteers and things like that. If you are interested in helping out, or if you have comments or feedback, tips, email us or give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-719-6947.